Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. Today is Wednesday, July 24th, 2019. We have six cases on our calendar for today, three of which are set for oral argument. The first of which is this one, A18-2027. Zhang, is that how you pronounce it? Zhang versus Minneapolis Public Schools. Both parties will have 15 minutes for their initial arguments, and then appellant, you will have 5 minutes for rebuttal if you so choose. Just to confirm, will there only be one? There are two people at each table. Will there only be one person arguing for each party?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, thank you. So when you are ready, attorney for appellant, you may approach the podium and please state your name for the record and the party you are representing. With that, counsel, you may begin.
Thank you. My name is Scott Cody. I am representing A. Zhang, the appellant in this matter. May it please the court, what we have here is a what you might call a sort of gap case. We have a situation where an employer makes a decision to terminate an employee, but does not actually inform the employee of that decision or implement the decision until some time has passed. In this case, about a week and a half passes in between. The question then is, what day was the employee terminated? On the day that it was decided he would be let go, or the day that he actually was told he was going to be let go? And the question matters, Your Honors, and I think it's actually a very significant question in employment law, because if you decide to affirm and say that the date of the decision by the employer is the adverse action, that's the date that the employee was terminated, no employee is going to have any protections under the law during that gap period. Anything can happen to that employee in between the decision and the actual firing, and the employee will not be able to protect himself or herself from it.
Well, is that really true? It doesn't seem like that would necessarily lead to a blanket rule, because wouldn't it depend on particular facts? And here, for example, I mean, you have to have some action that's tied to the unlawful termination. In other words, under the whistleblower statute.
That is correct. And to be clear, in this case, the district court did essentially put forth a blanket rule. The finding of the conclusion of the district court was that Mr. Zhang could not show causation because the decision was made before his protected activity. It was stated in that sense, Your Honor. I think the real rule and the rule that should be applied is not a blanket rule, but one that gives weight to the decision having been made before the termination is implemented, but does not make it dispositive of what the employee's rights are or are not. And I think this is the rule that already exists, Your Honors.
Why? I mean, the question is what motivated the causal connection. So what motivated the termination?
Yes.
It's a different question from when an employee knows that they have a cause of action accruing, which is what that case law that you want us to import here talks about. If the decision is the causal intent and the decision was already made prior to the protected activity, what difference does it make when the actual adverse employment action, the actual termination, occurs?
Your Honor, I think on one hand, there would be no difference at all if we were using a but-for causation standard. But that's not our standard. Our standard is, was retaliation a motive of the employer?
Right, but you
not
could
the only one.
True, but if you could still, if the decision is made on day one, the employee is notified of it on day 15, and on day, and the protected activity takes place on day 13. If all of the evidence is that the decision was made on day one, and there's no evidence suggesting, well, it could not obviously relate to the protected activity, don't you need to submit or produce evidence, some evidence that might at least create a disputed fact about whether that decision was motivated by the retaliation?
Yes, I think you absolutely do need to show some evidence of motivation. And I think this also goes to Judge Reyes's point, which is it's the action that we're concerned about. The decision to terminate is not what's unlawful. It is the action of terminating. Now, if nothing were to change between day one and day 15, I think you're absolutely right that a plaintiff couldn't make a prima facie case, because what evidence of causation of the notification of the act do they actually have? They don't have any if nothing changes. In this case, the district court made a finding that I thought, you know, was really helpful here on page 12 of its order. The district court said additional events related to the decision not to rehire plaintiff occurred after March 13th, 2017. So the court here is saying there were additional events between, they were related to the decision, which tells me it's related to the motive, the motivation, and they occurred after the decision was made. But the district court did not consider or even name those additional events, because it decided that once the decision was made, nothing else matters. What we're trying to say, Your Honor, is that things do matter in between. And you're absolutely correct. If nothing changes, if there is no change in how the employee performs or what activities he or she does or does not do, they're never going to be able to make a prima facie case. But here, we do have evidence in between the notification and on day one, the decision being made. What happened in between was Mr. Zhang engaged in protected conduct under the whistleblower statute. What we have in between is he was threatened with termination if he did not violate the law. And what we have in between, Your Honors, is that he was then notified of his termination before it actually was supposed to happen. These things enough should be enough to say there's a prima facie case of causation. But it goes even further, because after the notification, there continues to be evidence of motive. And it comes from the principal's own statements. It comes from the district's own statements. What Mr. Zhang really wants more than anything, of course, is reversal, which means a chance to put that evidence in front of a jury, which he should have the right to do. MPS's own statement is he was terminated, among other reasons, because he was insubordinate, because he didn't create a special education proposal, which he contends was unlawful. A jury should have the right to take that statement by the school district and say, was he terminated for insubordination? Right now, he's never going to get that chance.
He had a chance before the district court, though, a district court judge. And the district court judge did look at those facts, did look at that evidence. And I'm not so sure that the district court issued a blanket rule. The district court didn't say, as a matter of law, any person who any employer who decides to terminate a person and they subsequently engage in protected conduct, they're completely protected. And the district court judge is just ruling on these particular facts. And the district court did take into account those particular facts in its findings of fact. But it appears that the district court judge said it's pretty clear there are at least a couple pieces of evidence indicating that he was not going to be rehired. One, the statement that the decision not to rehire. Two, that decision being actually formally entered into the system. And three, the documentation as to, over that 2-year period, why he was underperforming. It wasn't like the causation seems very, very tenuous, because you've got a fairly significant record of a person not meeting, according to the school, not meeting the standards.
All of those facts are mentioned in the district court's order. I would point out, Your Honor, that all of those facts occur before the decision to not rehire was made, which means they also all occur.
Well, no, the decision to not rehire was made, what was that, March 13th. And so a formal decision was made, and that decision was documented. It was actually entered into the system, right?
That is correct.
Okay, so there's hard evidence right there.
Those facts, I would respectfully suggest, Your Honor, those facts are not relevant necessarily on the prima facie case that the plaintiff needs to make. They're extremely relevant on the question of pretext. Was his performance really as bad as the district claims it was? But those findings don't go to the question of, can he make a prima facie case of causation by showing evidence that his whistleblower activity was related to, did motivate his termination when it occurred. The facts that the district court did not consider and are not even mentioned are things like MPS's later statement, he was terminated for insubordination. The district court didn't
consider we can say that the district court didn't consider them. I think we could say the district court didn't consider them if they weren't even in the order, but they were part of the record.
I agree. It could be implied, Your Honor, and orders often have implications. But in this case, the district court's language was pretty direct, where it's saying other events, such as later statements that were made, do not change the fact that the decision was made before his protected conduct. As such, because the court finds that there can be no causal connection, it doesn't consider those facts. It's not simply a matter of not mentioning them and saying, you know, they were weighed. They were not weighed. And
I don't see how you can say they weren't weighed, because the district court says those events do not change the fact that the district court explicitly acknowledges those events, had listed them previously in the findings of fact, and then says here in the conclusions of law, while additional events related occurred, those events do not change the fact that the decision not to rehire was made prior. So the district court is taking those facts into account, but it's saying it doesn't change the analysis in this particular situation.
In a way, but the district court also says at one point on the actual issue of temporal proximity, which is potentially evidence of motive, the district court describes that as not relevant, showing it did, in fact, consider that evidence, but decided it was not that it didn't have the weight, not that it, you know, wasn't credible, but simply that it wasn't relevant. And it wasn't relevant because the court found that the decision not to rehire plaintiff was the adverse employment action. And that's the part that's wrong. It's not the decision that's the adverse employment action, Your Honor. It is the implementation. It's the act.
Right. I mean, I do understand your argument, because the element is there a causal connection between the adverse employment action and a protected activity? I don't have the order I'm not looking at right now, but the question is what motivated that? That's what causation is about. And
yes.
And if you had, a decision, here it was the principal decided not to renew, that was put into the whatever the system is, the dashboard. And then later events happened that also might or might not, in another case, motivate a decision. I think the question is there evidence? I know there is statutorily protected activity. I understand what you're saying about the report to the board and so on. It also listed, the later activity about the special education issue. But the question is there evidence that shows that motivated when the initial decision was already there? Like, do you have a case? I understand if there was a case that says, some ambiguity. Maybe it wasn't final. Maybe there was more to be done, and this also contributed to it. I think that's sort of the question. What shows that those later things actually contributed to the decision?
I think I understand what you mean. And the answer would be you can't show that because the protected activity had not happened by the time that the decision was made.
But doesn't that
and that's the district court's point, I believe.
Right, but later, once the protected activity happens, you're citing two events that occurred after that, like the handwritten note.
Before and after, Your Honor.
I'm sorry, the evidence that you, like the report to the board.
Yes, and also the principal's threat of termination, which happens before the adverse action.
I'm talking about after the protected activity.
Oh, yes.
Right, the evidence of motivation has to occur after the protected activity. For the protected activity to be causal. It has to have occurred first for it to have been causal.
That is correct,
right?
Yes.
But I think the question is whether there is evidence of some lack of finality about the decision or something that suggests that, they were going to non-renew, but There was also the motivating factor of what happened, of the retaliation for the protected activity, as evidenced by that later occurring documents, the three, yes. I think, that you cite.
Yes. I guess my opinion on this, Your Honor, is that you've got this U.S. Supreme Court case, Clark County versus Breeden, and it, to me, it addresses this situation. It says when the employer has previously made a decision to take some action against an employee, that, you know, matters, obviously, for their motive, why they actually then took the action. But it matters in a certain way. It does not preclude causation in that Breeden case. Simply says the employer's decision explains why the termination happened on the day that it did. And so temporal proximity between your protected conduct and the adverse action, that gets significantly undercut. I think this case, though, is, you can look at it a little better if you compare it to our Minnesota Hubbard case, Your Honor. And it's an older one, but that Hubbard case had a gap of months that the district of the court found the employer had decided we're going to terminate this person. It had nothing to do with protected conduct because it wasn't going to happen for months. On the prima facie case, however, the court decided, and I'll put the quotation for you, the court decided that the timing itself, when the plaintiff, I think, was terminated about two or so days after his protected conduct, the timing was sufficient for a prima facie case. The court recognized that the employer had long intended and meant to terminate this employee. And that was enough, though, for him to get to his prima facie case. The only point I want to make, and I'm out of time, is that the decision itself, whenever it's made, does not preclude causation because things happen in between that have to be considered and move to your next step of the burden shifting, which did not happen here. Which needed to happen, at the least. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Counsel, and you'll have 15 minutes for rebuttal. Counsel for responding, you have 15 minutes.
Good morning. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Suzanne Fisher, and I'm here today to represent the respondent, Minneapolis Public Schools. We're asking the court today to affirm the district court's decision granting summary judgment and dismiss the plaintiff's whistleblower claim because it was factually and legally correct. Now, you've hit on a few topics already, and I'd like to address the issue before you today. Is that simply the causation? Did the protected activity by Mr. Zhang on March 17th, was it motivated, causally motivated by, was it behind the respondent's decision on March 13th?
Well, the question is, okay. Is there any evidence of a motivating, of the protected activity being a motivating factor?
Correct.
Sufficient to establish his prima facie case?
Yes. Yes, Your Honor. So and in order to take a look at that.
Oh, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to interrupt.
Go ahead, Judge.
So why is it, if it has to be a cause or a contributing factor, why isn't the principal's threat to fire that occurred before Mr. Zhang was notified of the termination? Why isn't that enough to at least get past the prima facie showing and move on with the McDonnell-Douglas analysis?
Because the principal had already made her decision and entered it into the database on March 13th, days before Zhang engaged in protected activity. We dispute, the record is unclear, but for purposes of summary judgment, we accept for his allegations as true. But the motivation for her on March 13th was that his performance, where it's legitimately poor performance, not meeting expectations, in her opinion and in multiple other people's opinions who had familiarity with his performance over that two-year period. So in order for her to make her decision on March 13th, there was nothing but legitimate reasons. Now, he might...
Case, why did the school district keep talking about insubordination and issues like that as a basis for, as an additional basis for non-renewal of the contract? I mean, it seemed like they didn't need to do that. They've made your case more difficult for you than it needs to be, based upon what they did subsequent to the March 13th decision.
Perhaps, Your Honor, but those facts have not been determined as being accurate, right? And they occurred well after the decision and the notice that he was not be renewed by a third party.
But significantly, they occurred after the protected activity.
Correct. And they do not change the fact that Dr. Brooks Golden's decision on March 13th was always the same. She initiated the process of no rehire. The process continued. She never wavered from her decision.
Right. The question I have is, the employer is actually the school district. It's not the principal. And so the principal makes a decision not to, and bearing in mind the standard that, or the procedural posture we're here at, a summary judgment, right? Mm-hmm. All inferences mm-hmm. in favor of the non-moving party, et cetera. So principal makes a decision, puts in a dashboard. Then there's obviously apparently that doesn't effectuate it because there needs to be some review, or arguably, at least in where we are. It's not the district's final decision. And then later there's evidence like the threat to fire, et cetera. I mean, isn't it conceivable that the decision might not have been made in accordance with her initial desire, and then other motivating facts, specifically for purposes of this, the protected activity, also come into play and then represent the district's final decision, which is what it documented in the report to the board, is that right? The report to
yes.
the board. And I understand why you might argue, of course, they're going to put in everything to the board. They're not documenting employment decisions for purposes of a later lawsuit, they're documenting what happened in their view, right?
Right.
So I understand why they would put in insubordination if insubordination in their view happened, with even if it wasn't a motivating factor, just because they're being complete about the employee's record. But I'm considering that it's not a final decision and there are other things that come in, even if that's what motivated her principal entirely, what do we know what the district's motivation was ultimately in approving the termination?
Mm-hmm. Yes, Your Honor. There's no evidence that along the process, either the person whose job it is to review the support that's entered into the system, that he had any retaliatory motive. He did his due diligence in speaking with other people regarding the performance of Mr. Zhang. There's no evidence that anyone on the board had retaliatory motive to not rehire him. The decision by Dr. Brooks Golden, the principal, is important because it was her decision that never wavered. This isn't a case where it was a maybe he'll be rehired or gee, yes, let's rehire him. And then he engaged in protected activity. So that's a problem. But that's not the case here. She made her decision and she never wavered.
Does it matter that the decision to terminate, even though it had been made, let me ask you this question first. Is there anything in the record indicating when that termination was going to occur after the decision had been made in early March?
They have a somewhat of a process that's timing. And this particular, the rehire status of probationary teachers is part of the annual budgeting. And the record shows through the school administrator that budgeting was due. So the decisions needed to be made in terms of making the decision, are they staying, are they not? All of the decisions
right,
were made
right.
at the same time
Here's
and entered.
The, yeah, let me see if I can maybe clarify my question. So on March 13th, the decision had been made to not rehire him.
Yes.
Not rehire Mr. Zhang. When, is there anything in the record indicating after that decision to not rehire him had been made, when they would terminate him? In other words, at that point, is it up to Dr. Brooks-Golden as to when that termination occurs? Is it something that is the decision not to rehire, is that something that means that at the beginning of the school year in August or September, that he will not start with them again and he'll finish off the school year?
If I understand your question correctly, the process is that the decision is made and entered. The principal or her assistant principal advises the individual teachers within the March, early April area timeframe that they will not be rehired. Their contract is a one-year contract that goes through the end of the academic year ending in June, early June. So it's the actual consequence, if you will, of the decision to not rehire is at the end of the school year in June.
Okay, so and that's helpful because they didn't wait, the school didn't wait until that period, that whole process went through to ultimately terminate him. He was terminated 4 days after he refused to sign that, to put together that document. So he why isn't that temporal factor important here?
He wasn't terminated on March 21st. He was provided notice that he would not be rehired for the following academic school year starting in the fall. So his employment didn't end. I just want to make sure we're clear on that. So he wasn't terminated. He was provided notice of that termination, all right? It's an adverse action. Appellant has argued that the adverse action is the notice. I don't disagree because you need a prima facie case. The second element is an adverse action, but a whistleblower action. The Minnesota whistleblower protects or prohibits employers from taking adverse employment action because, and I quote, because in the statute, the individual has engaged in protected statutory conduct, right? So it's because you can't just look at the termination or the notice of termination. It's the relationships, the third element, causal connection. It has to be such that the protected activity generated or caused the decision to not rehire him for the following year. So without that, it's not a whistleblower.
So when we focus on that, which is the question is the decision, my question is, what does the record tell us about when that decision is finally occurs, I guess? Like the principal makes a decision. What's the process thereafter?
It goes in the dashboard. It's reviewed by somebody in HR as a standard. They input information of the decision, no rehire. They provide information. Dr. Brooks-Golden was very brief in all of her entries for probationary staff. The HR person asked for additional information. She provided additional details. It didn't change. It was performance-related basis for her decision.
Could HR overrule the principal?
No. This particular person could not.
Could the HR personnel advise the principal that the decision is not based on a solid foundation, mm-hmm. so to speak?
My understanding is that he would not advise the principal. He would go to his superior in employee relations. But part of his process, because there was a union representative of Mr. Zhang's that asked for review of it, and the HR talked to other people, not just Dr. Brooks-Golden, to confirm the support that she had provided as her basis for termination or no rehire, was solid, and he found no questions.
Thank you, and I might have stopped you before we finished the process. So prior to giving notification then to an employee, does the board need to weigh in?
No, they don't weigh in until like May.
Okay, so the principal is the decision maker on their renewal? Unless perhaps then it gets entered in if something were to come up from HR questioning it and then opening the issue and maybe there would be review.
Yes.
Okay, but it's not a board or other, there's not a other administrator above the principal who Well, I shouldn't
HR
say that.
Technically could, or the board could. And I don't want to misspeak in this case because Mr. Zhang's union representative asked for a review.
Okay.
I believe the board approved the non-rehire in May. There were other cases that may have moved forward through the April board meeting, but he was not one of those because it was under review.
I see. Okay.
So is it your position that the signing of the separation agreement on March 21st was not an adverse employment action?
That's a good question. I would say...
Probably get paid the big bucks.
I would say that the notice for purposes of establishing a statute of limitations timeline, as argued by appellant, is effective on that date of notice of separation.
Which raises another good question is, because there are cases on statute of limitations, but, and I will ask your opposing counsel here, are there any cases that are on point on this particular issue? Because there's a lot on statute of limitations in terms of that being the trigger, but what about the trigger for a whistleblower cause of action? What is the adverse employment action that triggers that?
I would say ultimately it may be the actual day of his last day of employment, but I'm not sure, Your Honor.
For statute of limitations.
For statute of limitations on a whistleblower, right. I'd like to make one other point, and that is appellant has pretty much totally disregarded and in fact ignored in his briefing to this court that on March 9th, Dr. Brooks Golden and the assistant principal met with Mr. Zhang, as they did with other probationary staff. That's part of the process. They advised him of her concerns about his performance and his employment status for the following year. That same night, Mr. Zhang emailed Dr. Brooks Golden thanking her for sharing her concerns and employment status for the next year. And he also acknowledged that her decision would be the discretionary decision as to whether he returned the next year. The Minnesota Whistleblower Act protects or prohibits employers from taking action based on protected conduct. It does not shield employees who know that their performance and their employment is in jeopardy. They cannot insulate, and we've cited some cases in our briefing, they cannot insulate themselves from the consequences of their poor performance. I see I'm out of time. I do respectfully request that this court affirm the district court's decision and that there be no causal connection within this. Plaintiff cannot get to the pretext stage, which they're arguing, without having made the prima facie case. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Counsel for appellant, 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you. I'd like to address a few of the points and questions that were raised during opposing counsel's argument. One question that came up is, are there any cases that apply Turner or the rule of the statute of limitations in this context? And I think it's related in a way to your question of, or what had just been discussed, of cases where employees have knowledge that their performance is bad or that their job is on the line. There is a whole line of cases that apply these rules that we're talking about, the rule of the statute of limitations. They might not reference it directly, but they use the language that the termination for causation purposes occurs when the decision has been made and communicated to the employee. And we cite several of those in our, I believe, first and reply briefs.
Right, but aren't those cases, don't they talk about those in context of the statute of limitations?
Let me be clear, Your Honor. There are, of course, a whole line of statute of limitations cases, and they'll all cite to this Turner versus IDS. But I'm talking about another whole line of cases simply on the question of prima facie case on causation, whether it's the whistleblower statute, the MHRA, any of the federal statutes. There are, of course, hundreds of cases that deal with a prima facie case and causation. Some of them involve gaps. Some of them involve a decision having been made before the employee was notified. Some of them involve the employer maybe not having decided to fire, but having contemplated it or having concerns about the employee. There are cases in this line where the employee is aware that his or her job is maybe shaky or on the line. None of those cases, Your Honors, preclude a showing of causation.
So, right, but...
Well, it's undisputed that the principal made a decision not to renew and put that in the dashboard.
Yes.
Is there any evidence that would create a genuine dispute of fact? I guess any evidence that the employer, the district, found that insufficient, didn't think it was enough, and therefore there's a factual question about whether the other activity contributed to it.
There is, and I would point to two things, Your Honor. One of them made it into the briefing here, one did not. The one that made it into the briefing is on March 22nd, the day after the termination, HR puts a note in this dashboard. And it says to the principal, before moving ahead with the no rehire discussion, provide information about the coaching and support that Mr. Zhang received. Now, the fact that this comes one day after, and it says before you have the no rehire conversation, it shows that the separation notice was not given when it was supposed to, which was another question that had come up. The other thing I would point to, Your Honor, is that over the next, I would say, month and a half, and this is all in the district court record, the principal added several more reasons to terminate Mr. Zhang. They were not all, and not even the majority of them, were restatements or supplementations of her original reasons. And this all going to the question of pretext.
What record evidence are you pointing to right there?
I'm not pointing, I'm just waving my hands. But in the district court record on the summary judgment motion, there was plenty of back and forth about additional reasons that the principal gave to terminate Mr. Zhang throughout March and into April.
Are you talking about the report to the board?
No, I'm talking about she initially had what was described, yes, as a very short list of evidence for not rehiring. She added to it, I think, three times over the next month and a half, so that instead of three or four reasons, there ended up being more than a dozen reasons.
Right. My question on that is, what's the significance of that?
Significance of that is it suggests that the original entry on March 13th may not have been sufficient. Which was
what,
the question.
Right. What if we conclude that initial one was sufficient, though? Does it really matter, then, what was added after?
I don't think it matters, honestly, whether it was sufficient or not sufficient, because the question is still, on March 21st, what motivated the termination? And as has been pointed out, things can happen.
And so just to be clear, your argument is March 21st is the termination, but wasn't he terminated later?
So March 21st, you're right, is the notification. The effective date comes a few months later.
Right.
The court in Turner considered, you know, that exactly, and they said it's the communicated notice that causes the employment to end, even though the consequences come after the effective date. He doesn't lose any pay until the effective date. The consequences are caused by that notification. If anything, Your Honors, and this was considered in the Turner case, if there's a dispute over what's the date of adverse action, if it's not the date of notification, it should be the effective date. There's no real scenario where the decision is the act. And that's the district's argument. A decision is an act, and it is not. And so we ask that you reverse, and I thank you for your time.
I've been wanting to ask this question, but I didn't want to interrupt the other questions here. Mine's a procedural posture question. This is a summary judgment dismissal. We've got de novo review here. The judge doesn't mention McDonnell Douglas analysis anywhere in his order. I think it can be implied from the order that he said there was no prima facie showing of causation. If we were to agree that that was a mistake, isn't the proper remedy then to remand this to the judge to do a further McDonnell-Douglas analysis rather than simply overrule summary judgment and direct that the matter be set for trial?
I think yes and no. The district court did use McDonnell and Douglas, and you're correct, did stop on the first step, saying, you know, I will not address the second and third steps. So you could remand and say continue with that analysis. What we argue alternatively, Your Honors, is that there is sufficient evidence of the motivation with these statements that were made, this summary to the school board, that you may very well remand with instructions to proceed to trial. And that is obviously our best case scenario and what we hope for. But at the very least, Mr. Zhang has a right to have a chance to have his facts that happen after the 13th be heard.
And I have one more question, and maybe this is really more of a clarification of what I've been trying to get at. Is there any case on point, or is this a case of first impression in terms of the determination of when the termination starts?
It essentially is a case of first impression. There are unpublished cases. There are some federal cases that say it more directly. But no case has said yet, for purposes of causation, what is the date or when does the adverse action occur? That's what I meant when I started. I think this case is extremely significant in the field of employment law for that reason. It shouldn't need to be said, but it now does need to be said. And so that's what we're asking you to say.
Okay. Thank you, counsel. We have no further questions. Thank you both for the briefing on this and for the oral arguments and really conversation to help us understand better the issues that are being presented here. We appreciate that. And we will be issuing an order within the 90-day statutory timeframe. Thank you all.